Hello, I'm Will Stein, and welcome to Geography Island Jams. This podcast is in the same style as the BBC Radio 4 Desert Island Disc series, whereby each episode I ask my interviewee what 8 songs, book, and luxury item they would want to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. For rights reasons, the music has not been included in the podcast. You can find links to the 8 songs on the LSE Geography and Environment website. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to Geography Island Jams. Joining me for this episode is LSE's Chief Philanthropy and Global Engagement Officer, Ben Pummer-Powell. Ben is a member of the school's Senior Management Committee and has strategic oversight for philanthropy, alumni engagement, corporate engagement, international strategy, and global academic partnerships for the LSE. His position involves overseeing LSE's 150,000 person strong global alumni community, in addition to working with thousands of donors, funders, and organizational partners. Ben's journey in academic philanthropy and alumni relations began soon after graduating Warwick University, when he became Director of Development and Alumni Relations at the Warwick Business School. From there, he moved on to Oxford University for 8 years, where he oversaw the university fundraising teams. Ben's educational indulgence began from birth, as both of his parents were teachers. He says his early family experiences, going to endless museums, churches and concerts, are what cemented his love for cultures, faith and the arts. Finally, alongside his role as Chief Philanthropy and Global Engagement Officer, Ben proudly chairs the LSE LGBTQ+ Steering Group, as well as working as the Senior Inclusivity and Diversity Champion. So welcome, Ben.
Well, thank you so much for the warm welcome and your generous words.
So to kick off, it wouldn't surprise me if a number of people weren't completely familiar with all the work Page does. So I was wondering if you could just start by outlining what is Page and what it's responsible for.
So some people may remember the division as Advancement historically. A major part of the work that the division does is focusing on creating wonderful opportunities for our global alumni community to keep connected with each other, with faculty and with our fantastic students. And then the role that philanthropy plays for the school. So that's working both with individual donors, many of whom are alumni and are incredibly generous to LSE, but also global individual philanthropists, corporations, and significant charitable trusts and foundations. But through the creation of the LSE 2030 strategy, and the notion of shaping the world, through the extensive feedback we had from staff, students and alumni, we identified that we needed to do far more with our international partnerships, not least to help with student global mobility opportunities, but also to create a proper corporate engagement operation. So Page kind of straddles all of those areas, and hence the name.
What does a typical day look like for you?
Wow, there's never a typical day. I feel I'm in such a privileged position in that I get to work across all school units, so across departments, centres, institutes, divisions, etc. But the same externally. So prior to COVID and lockdown, a lot of my time was spent on the road, meeting with our external supporters and friends. I'm delighted to say that's continued, but it's just shifted online, and I'm really proud of staff who've made sure that that's creative and enjoyable for those who are taking part, and that we're able to showcase the amazing faculty that we have and the research output that they're undertaking, but also to meet our students and to hear from them how they're learning and coping. And from our alumni, what's happening in different regions of the world, and this kind of feeling of coming together through COVID, I think, is stronger than ever. I know Manoush often touches on that. So a typical day for me normally will be 8 to 10 meetings on average. So in the world of Zoom and Teams, that's quite extensive. Whether it's from, you know, senior team meetings to meeting with key staff in the division through to meeting with donors and alumni and taking part in events. It's a great array of variety.
So you've said that you're incredibly fortunate to have two brilliant role models at the LSE, Manoush Shafiq and Andrew Young. Could you tell me why they're such great role models to you?
Yeah, because I think they lead with integrity. They lead with insight. They're strategic. But, you know, for all of those glittering array of skills and talents that they have, more than anything, they're human, they're people. They're willing to be honest and open and to acknowledge if things could be done better. And the way in which they lead is to empower others and to draw upon their strengths and their areas of specialization. And I see them doing that on a daily basis all the time. And that sets such a great model for me to aspire to.
And final question before we go into the music. So your position includes being on the senior management committee. What would you say is one of the most challenging tasks for the committee?
I think for any organization, when you're having to take a lot of decisions and often have to take those in quite a fast-paced environment, unquestionably, deployment of resource, both people and money, is quite often what the final crunch comes to. And I think we've seen that, particularly with the impact of COVID-19. And I think it's the way in which one has to balance out how do we do the best for our staff and students and externally for our alumni friends and partners that benefits the majority.
So now, Ben, we're moving on to the music. Can you tell me about the first song you're going to be taking with you?
So from our discussion thus far, Will, you can probably see that one of the benefits of my role and of my life to date has been the rich array of different people in my life, in my working life, in my personal life. And those people enrich my life so much. And there's a wonderful song from the Broadway musical Funny Girl, which was composed by Jules Stein, and it has lyrics by Bob Merrill. And of course, it's People. And who better to sing it than the fabulous Barbara Streisand?
So something else you've told me, which you get asked often, is, isn't it hard asking people for money? So what do you make of that question?
You're absolutely right. I'm often asked that, whether it's at a, you know, personal gathering or at work, or everyone always asks that question. And my response is, it really depends on how you go about doing it. Asking for money is actually a very small part of what our philanthropy officers do. The difference really with philanthropy is it's based upon relationships and common understanding and a desire to fulfill shared visions and outcomes. So when philanthropy works well, you're really presenting opportunities that draw upon an ongoing conversation where you take the time to listen and to learn about potential donors and funders. And then very carefully, I like the analogy that you are weaving together their interests and things that matter to them into this incredible tapestry that aligns with the institutional priorities. And you identify a shared collectiveness that is a wonderful collaboration. Look, none of us just make a gift by chance. We can all think about those areas that matter to us, that are tied to our families, our friends, our communities, and where we want and feel we can make a difference and impact, and to LSE's founding mission for the betterment of society.
So you've spent many years engaging with alumni. Do you think there are any misconceptions graduating students might have of joining the alumni community?
I think quite often more recent graduates think that we're only facilitating alumni engagement because we want to ask them for money. And don't get me wrong, you know, I said it's about opportunities. I hope when the time is right for all of our alumni, they will identify with an area that matters to them and they would want to support that area. You and I have both benefited from funding for our education, and my experience has been scholars always give back, which is great. But we're here to provide support to our alumni in a reciprocal relationship. And I think what particularly the past 5 years has shown us, with advances in AI that has had an impact on employment, you know, we're looking at graduates who are just entering the workforce now, who will probably change their careers 6 to 8 times. That was unthinkable when I first started going to university. And therefore, we need to provide ongoing opportunities for lifelong learning, to have opportunities to showcase the intellectual capital that's coming through the school, through events, through communications, etc. But also, I would hope this is a way of facilitating fun for our alumni. You know, when there's that opportunity to reminisce on the good days on campus and being in halls of residence and studying and being involved in clubs and societies, the alumni community is a way of keeping that going and keeping the pace.
Ben, we're now moving on to your second song. Can you tell me what it is and any reasons why you're taking it with you?
So, unsurprisingly, we've already touched on COVID, and I mentioned about the big challenges that we face globally, you know, whether that's obviously health, but also climate change and sustainability. I've touched on AI, for example. And I think the past 6 months has made all of us pause and really think, what matters in life? What do we want to achieve? I've certainly done that on a personal level, and I know we've done that collectively at LSE. And we've had some really, really dark days, and I've often talked to my staff about this. You know, I've said, look, we're all going to have good days and bad days, but if you're having a good day, let the sunshine come through a little bit more for your fellow colleagues, because if they're having more a rainy day, it can really help lift their spirits, and we can help carry each other through. So unashamedly, of course, it has to be somewhere over the rainbow. There will be more days of rain in the future, I'm sure, for that image of the rainbow bringing hope, but also just a bit of enjoyment and fun and sparkle. And who have I chosen to sing this particular song? Well, it's Kylie Minogue. Interestingly, Kylie first released this after she was diagnosed with breast cancer. And I saw her perform it on the Showgirl tour, and it's just magical.
So both your parents were teachers. Do you think that had an influence on why you went into philanthropy in academic institutions?
I certainly think it was a contributor. I mean, my parents not only supported our education, but they were always encouraging us to learn and to meet new people, to meet different people with from different backgrounds and different experiences. And although they were both teachers themselves, that afforded us longer holidays together, and in particular the summer holidays. And it was during that period that I remember we would get up really early in the hours of the morning and drive down to Dover while it was still dark, and we would board the ferry to go out to France and Italy. And as we saw the sunrise taking the crossing to Calais, it was this excitement of what was to come, because it was, like you've touched on, it was full of trips to museums and theatres and historic places, etc. And they're some of my happiest childhood memories with those holidays. But also the impact that education can have, and the fact that I was able to secure a scholarship to go to a private school, and then I had funding for undergraduate and graduate study. It's incredible what education can do, and certainly that started from the seeds of my parents.
Do you have any memories which you remember most prominently?
I mean, I remember with those summer holidays, and this actually links to my next track, by the time we'd reached the sizzling heat of southern France, the car windows wide open and you'd hear the crickets in the fields, and we'd often hear those camping at night. And it was the sound of Wham's Club Tropicana pulsing through the speakers, and I knew that holidays had arrived.
And with two parents as teachers, I'd imagine they would have kept you in line. Were you a mischievous child?
I'm slightly ashamed to say this. I think I was quite difficult for my parents growing up. I was the youngest of three. My brother and sister were that bit older. And I was always very clear on what I wanted to do, or equally what I didn't want to do. And yet at school, my teachers always said that I was so good for them. But I think that was part of the individual in me that didn't feel properly understood, and often didn't understand what was going on around me. And I'm pleased to say since then I've had the chance to talk about that with my parents and to apologize for some bad behavior. I would recommend anyone who has been in that situation does the same, but no, we laugh about it now.
So you say you have a great love for different cultures, faith and arts. Do you know where this love came from?
So my parents were immensely generous and kind and would take us to endless museums, churches, concerts on those magical holiday tours. And I remember in particular arriving in Italy, Verona was the city that captured my heart the most, not just because of Romeo and Juliet, but perhaps more importantly, it was arriving at the open air arena for the opera season. And as the aspiring wannabe opera stars lugged ice drinks around the Gradinata, which are the seats right at the top that were the cheapest, and they'd be selling ice creams as they sang snippets of arias. And I would sip my Diet Coke from a bottle, which I just thought was the most amazing thing. I was never usually allowed it, and that I'd purchased with my own pocket money. And you'd watch the sunset, and as dusk turned to night, the glitterati would appear below on the red carpet. The orchestra would take their seats, and the locals would actually pass along little birthday cake candles to light. So in the darkness, the whole arena would light up as the overture began to play, and then just brilliant music and a complete extraordinary performance. I can't recommend enough to anyone who hasn't had the chance to go. And that links to my next track. I remember back in the day in the 90s, there were several soprano stars, but there was one that stood out for me more than any other, and that was Daniela Dessi, and her singing Forze Lui from La Traviata by Verdi just will remain with me for the rest of my days.
You undertook a degree in education and arts at the University of Warwick, specializing in raising expectations and achievements of children from deprived communities through child-led learning. Can you expand more on what that is?
Of course. So my time at Warwick was fantastic, and I did a quite broad degree, actually, like you said, in education and arts. But I then moved into specialising actually in early years education, and specifically looking at underattainment in areas of deprived communities. And the reason for that is the research shows that those early years are so informative to future success and reaching full, realizing full attainment and ability. And the temptation in that situation is to undertake a very didactic form of teaching. We're specifically talking about 3 to 5 year olds here. Whereas actually, although you have to hold your nerve a bit with this, having a more child-led curriculum where it leads to self-discovery and hence more better understanding stands those children much better for the future. And I was pleased to work with two local education authorities on that. It drew upon a curriculum approach from a region in Italy called Reggio Emilia, which then led on to the Montessori schools. And it was just fantastic to see these really amazing young children really raising their attainment. And I often wonder how they're doing now and what they're doing with their lives.
Whilst at university, you did a good number of part-time jobs in order to finance your way through, which include delivering newspapers, fruit picking, working in a meat factory, cleaning, portering, filling vending machines and stewarding. Do you have a favourite or least favourite part-time job?
I can't believe that you mentioned the meat factory. That was just absolutely one of the worst things. Walking through the carcass room at 6 o'clock in the morning was not a good thing. The fruit picking was absolutely back-breaking and I had to cycle there and back to do it. But no, the real highlight, I think, for me working through my student years was landing a role in Warwick Uni's international office, which, funnily enough, I only secured by offering to one of the staff members to photocopy for free for a day in my way of trying to tempt them to give me a job. And fortunately, it worked. It took me to becoming a receptionist and then head receptionist. I then moved into the back office. And before I knew it, over a couple of years, I was running their orientation program for over 1,000 international students and managing a fantastic team of over 100 student volunteers, putting on a week's program.
And then after Warwick, you spent 8 years overseeing the university fundraising at Oxford University. Would you say the challenges are the same with Oxford University and the LSE?
I think the challenges, or as I prefer to view them, the opportunities are the same, in that, like when I was describing how philanthropy works, it's about a relationship, it's about a dialogue, and it's about an agreed set of goals that you're striving towards. And I think even Oxford, many, many years ago, hadn't done so well because they just hadn't gone and had those conversations with people, hadn't presented the opportunities that are endless in terms of making a difference and creating impact for good. And so although LSE is a little bit behind in terms of presenting those opportunities, I think we've seen a real shift over the past 2 to 3 years. And not only is that down to the great staff that are focused on this area of work, but the involvement of students, of our faculty, of school leadership, and really welcoming in those people who can provide that investment and make a real difference.
Just after your fourth birthday, your mother started taking you to Suzuki violin lessons, as well as personally teaching you how to play the piano and read music. Were you always enthusiastic when learning to play music, and are you still into music now?
Great question. Goodness, it was just after my fourth birthday, as you say, when I went to those violin lessons. And although the excitement was there for the first lesson, I think soon after that, my mother had to do a lot of chivying to keep me going. I mean, I suppose at that age, I just remember it was so tiring having to hold the violin up. And I would have to use these different tricks of putting a sweet in a certain place on the violin. And if I could hold it there for long enough, then you had the sweet. I mean, it was the classic kind of tricks of the trade. And she kind of had to really keep me going with it until I would say about 10 or 11. And then suddenly something changed and I really took on a love for it myself. Maybe it was partly because I'd just learned how to play with vibrato, and then I was away. And thank God she kept me going, because I still have my violin now. I don't play it so much. Sadly, the piano didn't work out so well. I didn't keep up with that. But also she gave me a love for singing, and that's something that has certainly remained with me. I was head chorister at school, then went through that horrible turmoil that one does of, you know, voice dropping, and then you lose all of those high notes that you could sing. And that is, you know, people still talk about it. It's quite difficult to overcome that. And then took up singing lessons and sang tenor and have done so thereafter.
Your mother passed away a few years ago, and to celebrate her legacy and to raise funds for your local hospice, you launched the Pink Rose pop-up restaurant in Oxford. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. So, I mean, obviously at the time of Mum's passing, it was a terribly sad period, but also as a family, we were really committed to celebrating Mum's life and what she'd done for us and the things that she'd imparted in us and that we could continue with. So in 2017, to help raise funds for our local hospice, we launched the Pink Rose pop-up restaurant in our then home in Oxford. We provided 36 covers in one day, and those individuals sampled an 8-course tasting menu with carefully selected wines that we'd found on visits to France. So continuing that legacy too. And along with an amazing team, yeah, somehow I managed to cook up the goods, but also sang some arias and show tunes for those who were gathered. And I shared one of my all-time favourites. That's my next song. It's from Puccini's La Bohème. I will always think of the great Caruso singing this. And it's Rodolfo, who has just met Mimi. And he sings to her, "Che gelida da manina, your tiny hand is frozen." And it captures the moment of meeting a new person or people, wondering who they are and what they're doing, and encouraging them to share. And it's what I do in work, and it's also what I do outside of work. And through that process, you really reflect on one's own life and my own, as I do it, my own shortcomings through the process. But rather like education, I feel the more we learn, the more ignorant we feel. And I think that's an important but also a positive part of the journey.
Can you now tell me about the next song you'll be taking with you?
So we just touched on my mother and the love for music. And I think this is possibly one of the most eerily beautiful pieces of music ever written. It's from a collection of folk songs from the Auvergne region of France, and it's by Cantaloube. And it was actually written between in the 1920s, but over many years. And it's the Chant d'Auvergne. And for me, it will always be sung by Kiri Takanawa. And I remember my mother playing that to me from a very early age. And I still get it out now and pop it on from time to time. And not only is it beautiful, but I find it incredibly liberating and freeing. I hope everyone enjoys it.
Growing up in a religious family made coming out a difficult process for you. Can you tell me a little bit more about your coming out experience?
Sure. So, I mean, I had a deeply religious upbringing, and coming out as gay was really tough. And I remember I didn't really know where to turn. Indeed, I didn't come out until after university, actually. And I think it sounds so odd now, but I don't really remember knowing many LGBTQ+ people when I did come out. And perhaps that was having been so constrained through church and the communities around that. But after university, and despite a good job and generous friends and a deeply loving family around me, I just felt though that I was going to burst. And I finally came out to a couple of close friends, followed by my family and then more widely. And the support of many individuals at that time was transformative, as was finding real love for the first time. And this actually brings me to the next song. and quoting from it. It's from Depuis le Jour. It's Act Three of the French opera Louise by Gustave Charpentier, and of course sung by Maria Callas. But my dream was not a dream. Love spreads its wings over me, and everything resonates.
In 2006, you went to the Greenbelt Festival. Can you tell me what the festival is and the story behind it?
Absolutely. Greenbelt, for those of you who don't know, is a spectacular explosion of faith, arts, and justice. It's a whole mixture of different events, etc. And I went for the first time, as you said, in 2006. And I remember walking across Cheltenham Racecourse, wondering what I'd come to. I'd had it recommended by a couple of people. But I found newly found friends there, and where we were camping for the festival. And actually, this is where I saw, coming out of a Racing Green Mini, my future best friend, my biggest cheerleader and husband. And from inside the car, I could hear the dulcet tones of Catherine Jenkins. I remember it was her 2004 album, Second Nature. And next month, Rich and I will actually celebrate our 11th wedding anniversary and our 15th virtual festival together. Sadly, it won't be camping this year. It's going to be online. But since then, Rich and I have had the opportunity to meet Catherine, and she generously actually shared our story of meeting at one of her concerts. And, you know, after that very first weekend, that first festival at Greenbelt, I knew afterwards, after a weekend of discovery and joy, that I would never walk alone again. And that's why I've chosen that particular song, with Catherine Jenkins singing it.
So you chair the LGBTQ+ steering group. What kind of things does the steering group do, and are there any initiatives you're working on at the moment?
I'm very fortunate in that Spectrum is made up of a fantastic group of individuals representing Spectrum, which obviously is our staff LGBTQ+ group. There is a student representative representing our student body, and we also have a member of our alumni who links in with our LGBT alumni group. And what we're there to do is to look at how best the school can change policies and processes to improve the experience of our LGBTQ+ staff and students, and to make sure that we're being as inclusive as possible and that we're following examples of best practice within other organisations. And I'm really proud that we're in the top 100 Stonewall Employer Index, but I always say we can do better. And I've valued so much hearing from the individuals, their personal stories, and where they've been able to draw upon the stories of others. And I always say, and, you know, I spoke several months back at Spectrum, if we take the time to listen and if we take the time to learn, we can really make a difference. And that in particular has been really important with our trans community, who we need to do much more for. And I would just encourage anyone who is listening to this to take the time to listen and to learn, and try and understand where individuals are coming from, because we can do so much more, and that's what we're committed to.
So I believe I'm right in saying that cooking has been a big part of your life. Are you able to give me a favourite dish you like to cook?
That is so difficult, because I love cooking many different things. However, one that never seems to fail and always goes down so well is my mother's recipe for chocolate mousse. It has no cream in it. It's only dark chocolate, eggs, and a bit of sugar. And really, it's just about the order in which you put it together. But I always love whipping that up, and remembering her and seeing everyone devour it, even if they're full from the main course.
And the final question is, what is your favourite thing about being part of the LSE?
It's so hard to choose. But I think fulfilling our founding mission and our amazing community of staff, students, alumni, friends and partners who make this a reality is such an immense privilege. And again, through C19, it reminds you how fortunate we are. And that's often down to the people that we work with and have the opportunity to engage with and partner with. And that makes it all the more worthwhile.
And now we're moving on to the final section. So you're on the island, you're provided with the Bible, the beverage reports, and a book of your choice. What is the book you're going to be taking with you?
So as we're speaking, I'm surrounded by books, and this has been so hard to choose, but I've tried to imagine what it would be like being on the island. And I'm a firm believer that fun and laughter is really important. Growing up, Roald Dahl was one of my favorite authors. And there was just something about his book, Dirty Beast, that really caught my imagination. And I think to keep creativity and innovation going on that island and to keep smiling and laughing, I would choose Roald Dahl's Dirty Beasts.
And finally, but by no means the least, what is the luxury item you'll be taking with you?
So, recent research has shown that sleep is really underestimated. I think it's come more to the fore recently in a digital world and being online so much. How do we get a good night's sleep? So I'd have to take my bed.
At least you're going to be well slept on the island. Well, Ben, that brings us to the end. Thank you very much for sharing your Geography Island Jams with me. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much for the invitation. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you today. And like with everyone who's listening, keep well, keep connected.